It was 6 years ago today, the first Sunday of 2013, that the Lord allowed me to begin my journey at First Baptist here in the city of Far. So it's been 6 years. And for the last 6 years, or the last six Januaries, we have done a series very similar to this. We typically call it the State of the Union. This is the series where we launch not only the vision or the values of the church, but we take on the task of retaking the conversation over who we are and specifically what we do. Obviously, you want to get into the why we do what we do, but what I want us to do for the next few minutes, I want us to go into this concept of succession. I believe that this is the year within the core values of the church that we are going to be very intentional to work as families, as individuals, as the body of Jesus, to work in the ministry of succession. Obviously, the graphic, I hope, is self-explanatory, but it's the concept of a generation passing on, in our case, our product, so to speak, which is the gospel. That's the reason why we are here. And we're going to explain what the gospel is. But this concept of passing on, and again, just sharing and the continuation of this experience, in my personal view, there is no better way to illustrate that in the scriptures than through the life of a guy by the name of Paul, the Apostle Paul. He invested his life to do exactly this. He discipled, he trained, he gave. Eventually, he's going to sacrifice even his own life for the purpose of passing on exactly the gospel. I'm asking you to go to the book of Colossians, if you have a Bible, because in the book of Colossians, he's going to speak to churches, house churches, multiple endeavors, where he's going to have the underlying concept of succession in this principle. Now, this is why I believe Colossians, and specifically Paul, are crucial for our conversation for multiple reasons. And one of them has to do with the fact that he's writing this letter from prison. This is a letter that reflects his passion for the church in an environment of incarceration. He is limited physically to be and to do this in a more tangible way. Actually, he writes this letter to a group of churches in this area of Colossa that he did not plant. Those are not his churches necessarily. They were planted by a disciple of Paul. So still, he feels the responsibility from the apostolic venue, from the apostolic position that he is supposed to shepherd, to lead, to serve these churches. So in the incarceration, he's in prison and he writes this letter. So that creates a sense of urgency to do this. Second urgency, second component that creates the urgency is that every one of these writers, every one of these apostles, they wrote these letters, they wrote these epistles, knowing and believing that Jesus was coming back in their generation. So the worldview of these individuals, when you read this, they're anticipating Jesus anytime, any moment in their generation. So hopefully this is the year that you and I go through life practicing the ministry of succession, not simply to improve the behavior of children and grandkids and the economy and the marriage. I hope and those things are important and they do get better. But with the understanding that if we do not do this practice, if we do not exercise this principle, there might be a generation of men and women who may not get to know Christ because of a generation, previous generation, you and I, that we were negligent. So Paul writes with a sense of urgency because Jesus is coming back. The third reason why Paul writes this letter within the concept of succession is because he's writing to a generation, and again, illustrated by the younger generation, these brand new churches, that they are in disarray, confused. It's chaos and madness. Those are churches that doctrinally, they are in turmoil. And people are giving up. People are changing the essence of the gospel, the product they're passing on. People are adding to the product. So in this time in history, the church is made of basically three components, which is very bad. The first one is Christianity. So they have embraced the gospel. They have added Greek philosophy, Gnosticism. I'm going to explain that, what it means. And then they added Jewish legalism. I don't blame them because that's where they come from. That's their worldview. And we believe that this experience of succession is actually a process. It's not an event. It begins with an event, but it's a process. So, again, from being incarcerated to Jesus returning in their generation, which that's how they've always functioned, and then to the confusion and disbelief, and then the giving up of some of these churches and Christians, that's how Paul brings the the teaching and specifically the admonition. So in our minds, I want us to picture the concept of a courtroom, that you are before the judge. Paul is before the judge, before the church, and he's debating them. He's creating a rebuttal of something that is going on. And in this case, Paul, what he's going to bring in his teaching, three quick things that I want you to write on your handout, if you have one, or in your bulletin. And this is how he's going to address, he's going to go after this issue. He's going to introduce Christology, which is basically like biology or zoology, is the study of something. So in this case, is the study of Christ. He's going to introduce missiology, which is the study of missions, and then eventually ecclesiology, which is the study of ecclesia. We get the word in Spanish, iglesia, church. So here's what I want you to hear. Those are kind of uncommon words, not very, you know, everyday words, but this is what it means. Christology simply means everything that Jesus said about himself. In other words, Paul is writing to churches who they created their own versions of who Christ is or was. And that's the problem. So I love to hear your story, your testimony, your upbringing, you know, where you were before, your previous church, your previous experience. Those things are important. But what becomes transferable, what is the core of our succession, is not your thinking, my thinking, our ideas, our desire, our disbelief, our discouragement. It's whatever Jesus said about himself. Not what you and I think about Jesus. Tracking what I'm saying? Again, I'm not in a disagreement with what you say. All that I care is about what Jesus said about himself. That's Christology. So Paul is saying the antidote is Christology. The second thing is basically the behavior of Jesus. Missiology, or the mission, is simply what Jesus did based on who he is. In other words, this is his character. This is the expression of the character. This is who he is, or what he said about himself, and this is what he did and why he did that. And eventually, those two components, when you put them together, that's what makes the church the church. Now, here's what I want you to hear this closely. I want you to substitute this word church or ecclesiology or church for your last name, meaning your family, maybe your marriage, maybe your studies, if you're single, maybe your dreams, maybe your past, maybe your fears, maybe the uncertainty of 2019, maybe the regrets that you and I have from the previous year. Whatever it is about our lives, financially, relationally, emotionally, mentally, I want you to hear this closely. This is why I believe the series is crucial. Although we're focusing in the church, although this is about kind of the state of the union, you know, this is where we're going as a church, but you are the church, I am the church, we are the church, implying that our lives, our thoughts, our emotions, our speech, our behavior is what makes us who we are. So for us, the win is that our lives, our marriages, our children must embrace what Jesus said about himself, and your thinking and your emotions, your finances must embrace what Jesus did. So I'm going to put it to you very simple. All that I'm trying to tell you is this, that for 2019, I don't believe we need to pray for God's will. I believe what we're called to do is to rediscover what he said about himself and what he did for 33 years. And whatever those things are, that's exactly what's supposed to be our agenda. That's exactly what we're supposed to be and do. And the opposite is also true. Hear me say this. Whatever Jesus didn't say about himself, whatever Jesus is not, and whatever Jesus didn't do, we don't do it. Tracking? So if Jesus didn't do it, we do not apologize for not doing it. We just don't do it. I know culture does it. I know, you know, the previous experience did it. I know this is the way I was trained. But if Jesus didn't say it, if Jesus didn't spoke about it, and if Jesus didn't actually exercise it or exemplify it, we don't do it. So whatever moves against the character of Jesus, we simply don't do it. Now, again, I'm bringing this up to you because that's exactly the problem for these churches back then, 2,000 years ago. They were disregarding Jesus, and obviously they were disregarding the work of Jesus. So how does he go about it? Here's how he goes about it. So again, go to chapter 1, verse 15. And he begins by simply saying, the Son, not the church, not the leaders, not the pastor, not the Roman government, not Caesar, Augustus, not your fears, not your experiences, not your passion or desires. It is the Son, and in this case, capital S, implying Jesus Christ, is simply the image. Jesus is the image of the invisible God. So he begins by simply reversing the statement of the church in this case. The church had their own definition of the Son. Some of these people, because of Gnosticism and Greek philosophy, they believed Jesus was 100% divine. So he was God. He wasn't just simply 100% man. So in other words, the work of Jesus was always kind of in their minds, in the church's mind, it was like there are some angels, and then Jesus is the biggest or the greatest of the angels. But he wasn't really the way to the Father to be saved. You have a generation where legalism, Jewish legalism, that they were married to the law. They wanted to perfect the law. And he's basically saying, see, God is not someone that you go to. God is someone that has come and dwell among us. So when he says that he's the image of God, in my mind, I just thought of this reflection, of this image, that Jesus is literally the perfect reflection of who God is. Although he is God, but listen to the language. He's using the language of the invisible God making himself visible. Now, growing up, and some of you maybe still do this, and you did it when you were little. Remember when they told you never to look directly into an eclipse? Because apparently it's going to damage your sight. So typically, I remember growing up, you were supposed to get a bucket, put water on it, and through the reflection on the water, you're able to see the eclipse. Anybody know what I'm talking about? Because if you look at it directly, it's supposed to damage. Think in those terms when it comes to God. There is no way that you can see God directly. So the fact that he says that he is the image of God, what Jesus has done, he has made the terrifying, the overwhelming, the consuming presence of God has made God beneficial. So in my mind, going back to electricity, I think of an electrical system. Electricity is lethal. My father was an electrician for 26 years, and I remember multiple times my dad getting electrocuted. I remember workers, co-workers of my dad dying, being electrocuted, because it's lethal. What makes electricity beneficial in this room, and we're able to use technology and the microphone and air conditioning, is because electricity becomes beneficial and measurable through not the positive, not the negative, but the, what's the third one? The ground. Come on, you know what I'm talking about, right? Are you guys awake? It's the ground. So the ground is what actually grounds electricity, that the voltage in the system is beneficial. I want you to listen to that in the words of Paul, that when he says that he is the Son of the invisible God, is that God is uncontainable. God is unmeasurable. God will consume you and I. So the way that we relate to God is through putting our trust, our faith, which is the ground, that we are able to contemplate and receive enough of God to be saved through Jesus Christ without being consumed by his presence. And this is why when it comes to atheism, and some of us, we have made the mistake to temper with atheism, and we question the existence of God, and people say, I don't have faith, you know, faith is nonsense. Or people say that faith is simply weakness, you know, for you religious people. It's basically people saying that they do not need the reflection of God. They can handle God on their own. In reality, they're making themselves God, which I don't know about you and this, but we make very puny gods. We make horrible gods, right? I mean, it's like, anyways. So again, Jesus basically becoming the image of the God of the scriptures. And then he goes and says this. He's not only the image of the invisible God, but he's also the firstborn over all creation. So he is supreme. He is God himself. But at the same time, he is the leading. He is the catalyst. He is the reason why this world exists. Now, for us, when we think about the supremacy of Jesus, Paul is very clear on what that means. What that means and what that entails is that, again, the invisible God has become visible. This is the mercy of God, is that he has come and dwelt among us. He is Emmanuel. We celebrate that in Christmas. But now, look at what that means. That means that in Jesus, the visible God that was invisible and made himself visible, it is in him that, how many things? And again, I want you to make the effort to think about the audience of Paul. He's writing to the churches that are primarily made of Gentiles, non-Jewish people, implying that the mindset, and I'm thinking right now of the Sadducees. There were Pharisees and Sadducees. The Sadducees were the most influent religious group within the Judaism by the Greeks. And the Greeks had the ability, this is the philosophy that is infiltrating the church back then, had the ability to divorce the heaven and the earth, meaning the spiritual and the physical, the visible and the invisible, the tangible and non-tangible. And then he goes and says, he is Jesus, the Son of the invisible God. He is that everything was created for him, through him, that it is heaven, earth, visible, invisible, thrones and powers and rulers and authority. What's the point? Here's the point. He's basically telling the church, Paul is telling the church, that in Jesus, through Jesus, he created the world. And everything that he created was good. Eventually, Genesis chapter 3 brings the curse, not only to man, but to creation. And unfortunately, there was a disconnect between God and the goodness of life and the goodness of, obviously, God in creation. And that disconnect had consequences. When Jesus came and him becoming the image of the God, the invisible God, that implies that him being the firstborn of everything created, he has the power to bring together the invisible and the visible. You guys, speaking to the church, you guys have the mindset that as long as you believe the right thing, it doesn't matter what you do. See, that explains why these people struggle so much. And if you read 1 Corinthians chapter 15, it's Paul, again, creating a defense against the church in Corinth because they do not believe of the resurrection from the dead. Like, they basically saying, I believe in Jesus, I'm okay with Jesus, but once you die, game over. Now, look at me for a second. I am concerned that some of us, as we speak right now, have the same mindset. Some of us do not believe, truly believe, that there is life after death. Some of us do life as if this is it. And if that's your worldview, look at me for a second. If that's your worldview, I don't blame you why you live in so much anxiety, why you treasure so much your possessions. Tracking? Because if this is all that it is, there is no wonder why you and I live for pleasure and pleasure's sake. Because we have to enjoy, be merry, and what's it saying? It's just, come on, just get drunk, just do what you do, because tomorrow you may die. Well, that sounds like a country song, right? Well, the reality is that he's saying Jesus has the ability to bring those things together. It's not an either or, it's a both and. The supremacy of Jesus is over heaven, over earth, over the visible and the invisible, over every single thing. So in my mind, again, just translating the words of Paul about Jesus' supremacy, I thought about our experience. A couple of years ago, Arely and I, we were privileged to go and celebrate our anniversary by making a trip, not by driving, but flying over the Grand Canyon. And it was beyond comprehension. Not just the sight, not just the view, not just the experience to visit this amazing place, but when we traveled and we flew for about 45 minutes in the helicopter. That's how we got to the Grand Canyon, helicopter. And I was like a typical valley person, ready with my camera and ready to go. Man, great to take pictures. And when we finally made it to the Grand Canyon, I was just going, I mean, I cleaned the little glass, and I said, I got to take the best pictures. After the third or fourth picture, I put my camera away, and I said, this is never going to make justice to the majesty of this place. Some of you have been at the Grand Canyon, but we were privileged to see the Grand Canyon from above, and it's just beyond comprehension. So I'm excited. We're just looking at this thing, and it's just amazing. In my mind, I'm going drawn back to the concept of him as the creator of everything, that Jesus, literally with his breath, when he spoke, the Grand Canyon came into existence. It is Jesus that when he took dust from the ground and he literally just breathed the breath of life, Adam came into existence. That's what he's implying. Now, there's a point in the trip that, again, we're just overwhelmed with the Grand Canyon and just, I mean, so excited. But there's a point where the helicopter lowers enough that we can see the actual people that are looking at the Grand Canyon on the ground. And that's where my mind went to a different level of just amusement. Because when you see people at the Grand Canyon, your perception of the size changes because now you have a point of reference, how big that thing is. How majestic it is. So obviously, with my college degree and my master's degree, I felt puny. I was like, well, I've been in ministry since 1990. So what? Oh, I'm bilingual. So what? I got dual citizenship. In other words, all of my credentials that I've always argued and put as a badge of honor, when you see the majesty of these things and you see the creation of God, obviously you think about the solar system. And you see a scale figure of the sun, and you want to think that we are the biggest and the sharpest, knife on the drawer. Well, this is Earth right here. And we still act and behave as if we are the center of the universe. Paul is reminding us that he is the son of the invisible God. He is the image of that invisible God, that he is the firstborn of everything that has been created. So what does that mean? This is what it implies. It implies that all things, everything that we listed, all things have been created through Jesus. He spoke those things into existence, and they were created. What's the point? Here's the point. If you're writing notes, that implies that he is the agent of creation. God created through Jesus. I'm going to say that again. God created through Jesus. But everything that has been created is for Jesus. Does that make sense? See, in other words, here's what I'm trying to tell. Again, just don't miss this. All that I'm trying to tell you is that when you disregard the supremacy of Jesus, when you disregard the majesty, the glory, the holiness, when you and I do not see Jesus as God himself, you and I, we're going to make ourselves the agents of creation. So these are my kids. This is my money. This is my time. It's my sexuality. It's my marriage. Anybody tracking what I'm saying? The supremacy of Jesus puts me in perspective. The supremacy of Jesus is not the improvement of our relationships. It's that we understand that my relationships, my youth, my dreams, my fear, my failures, they were created for the goal of Jesus. Now, I'm not saying that your failures and your mistakes or your sin glorifies Jesus. All that I'm saying is that since Jesus is supreme, he can still not only redeem your past, but he can receive honor through the redemption of your past. That he is not the God that is waiting for you to get your act together, and he's going to eventually love you when you get a better version of yourself. Jesus loved you not for the man or woman that you were supposed to become. He loved you when you didn't deserve to be loved. Because, see, when he is the agent of creation and everything is created for him, allows you and gives you the ability and the freedom to understand that you are not a creator like Jesus is. You still can create things, not what Jesus has created, and you are not the reason why things exist. And I don't know about you, but that is freedom. That is the ability to understand, look at me, that my role in this whole deal of life, this whole deal of the church, of marriage, of family, and whatever else is in my life, is that I am a manager. I am a steward. I'm just a co-laborer. We just read that he is the firstborn among everything. So although I am a child of God, listen to me, we just sang that. I'm a child of God. My position of being a child of God is not the same as Jesus' position of the Son of God. Tracking what I'm saying? He's a unique Son of God. Why? Because he's God. So is he the Son or the Father? And the answer is yes. Yeah, you're learning. I'm glad. See, that's the both end of the conversation. And we don't like that because we're very black and white. Am I going to heaven? Am I going to hell? No, listen. This is the time where we literally take the teachings of Jesus and here's what it means. Paul is just in prison, just giving us some of the deepest theological principles. It is Jesus that is before every single thing. So I just gave you a picture of the imagery of the Grand Canyon. I just show you the earth and everything. I just show you that beautiful Jaguar, and the image. What he's telling us, what Paul is telling us, is that you and I, we need a point of reference, that our minds are finite. We cannot think beyond time. That's why when you see a picture, apparently, of the oldest constellation, the oldest galaxy in the world, in the cosmos, apparently is 13.8 billion years old. I have no clue what that means. I don't know what 13 billion years is. But all that I know, based on what Paul is saying, is that Jesus is before that. Tracking what I'm saying? So the point is the eternality, the supremacy, that in him, all things, what happens? Look at me. All things come together. So if you're sitting in this place and you're privileged to walk with your bride as a man, as a married man, for X amount of years, it's because he has held you together. Tracking? If you're in this place and you have gone through ups and downs, you have gone through the deepest of pain and sorrow, and you are listening to the sound of my voice, and you are able to comprehend through the Holy Spirit the message that Jesus is before time, before Adam was created, before the world came into conception, before the thought of men came into existence, Jesus is. Jesus wasn't created. Jesus wasn't formed in some shape and form. Jesus has always existed. And the point of the supremacy of Jesus Christ has to do that we have to have a point of reference. And that point of reference is so we can understand that in a little tiny cul-de-sac, in a little world, whether it's family, last name, the little money or the big money you may think you have in your account, the big dreams and plans you have with your job and your schooling and your kids and your grandkids, He wants to show you through the local church, through the fragile, through the brokenness of the church in Colossae, the audience, broken churches, First Baptist Far, broken church, your marriage, my marriage, broken, our lives, because He holds us together. He's using our condition to remind us that He is supreme, He is divine. He is authoritative. He is the ruler, not only of the cosmos of creation, but He is also the head of the... In other words, look at me for a second. When you look at the dysfunctionality of churches, Paul is saying marriages, family, government, nations, individuals. The problem with our dysfunctionality is not because we are just difficult people, we are just full of mistakes, we have so many fears, or we are heading into a generation that is just godless. You know why? You know what the problem is? The problem is not who we are. Everybody knows who we are. Everybody knows how broken we are. The problem is the absence of the supremacy of Jesus. Paul is reminding us that if you're going to experience God in 2019, must begin with the supremacy of Jesus. And in tangible ways, we have to understand that we as a church, we are not the head. We are the body. You have to stop thinking that you are the reason things are created and that everything is created because of you. No, Jesus is the reason why things are created. The church exists because of Jesus. Jesus created the church. The church is sustained by Jesus. And Jesus, look at this, Jesus is the reason why the church is created. So what does that mean for us? Is that we are simply the body, and He, Jesus, is the, what does that mean? He's the beginning. So in my mind, again, just trying to get these things, and I apologize for the small pictures. I was supposed to make them bigger, and I couldn't, or I didn't. But do you recognize these nice-looking brothers? Now, if you Google them, not right now, but if you look at their Twitter or Instagram, they look older. So right, those are, they're older. Time is catching up on them, right, because we're limited. But what do they have in common? As actors, is one character that all of them have made. Anybody remembers, knows? When Paul says that He is the head, we are the body, and He is the beginning, He is the blueprint, He is the originator, He is the creator of a brand new race, not the race of bad men. This is what came to mind. This is Jesus. Back in the 60s, remember? No? Old enough to remember the original bad men? He recently died. But that's what Paul is saying. This is a race. This is a brand new thing, and every year progresses, and some of you love one of them, some of you hate the other ones, and some of you prefer, from George Clooney to Val Kilmer, and you can pick your preference on the actors and the characters display. But Paul is saying, here's the bottom line. There is one originator. There is one beginning. There's the founder, the creator of a brand new experience, the local church, the body of Jesus. He is the owner. He is the beginner. And part of this beginning is understanding that this beginning gives Him supremacy. Again, I just gave you verses 13, 14, 15. We just gave you all these verses up to 16 with this whole concept of the supremacy of Jesus. He's the world creator. He breathed things into existence. And only when you see the supremacy of Jesus is when you are able to experience your humility. So if you are going through a time in your life, in your parenting, in your grandparenting, that maybe your marriage maybe yourself, myself, we're going through the opposite of humility. We're being prideful, or she's been prideful. He's been unforgiven. I cannot forgive them. Listen to me for a second. See, humility is not the result of people who simply humble themselves. Humility is the result of the supremacy of Jesus in our church, in our lives. So for us, that implies, this is the tangible reality, that if he is the head of the church, which is the body, and he is the beginning, look how Jesus obtained, experienced the supremacy in his life. He became the firstborn among the leaders of the world, the kings. He became the firstborn among the dead. In other words, the supremacy of Jesus is found when he chose, being in the condition of God, equality with God, he chooses to come into the world. And when I say he came into the world, I'm thinking of being in the condition of God, with being one with God, second person of the Trinity. He chooses to come into the world to do what? To rescue, not men and women who were gasping for air, not for marriages that were feeling that they were drowning, not for financial situations that they were hoping 2019 will become better. See, for Jesus to come and rescue you, there's one prerequisite this morning. You have to admit that you're at the bottom of the ocean, lifeless. You're not bringing any bubbles. Bloop, bloop, bloop. Those bubbles are gone. You are dead. I'm dead on my sin and trespasses. I'm dead because I've always believed that I exist with supremacy, that I'm the reason why things exist. I rule my life. Nobody tells me who, what to do and how to do things. So Jesus, his supremacy, as we read, is a supremacy that he chooses to come and die in our place. That the death of Jesus is that allows him to put everything in perspective. So if you were to experience the fullness, the supremacy of Jesus, you have to join Jesus in his tribulations, in his suffering. This is why constantly I ask you to stop thinking about why things happen to you. If the goal is not your supremacy, if the goal is not your stability, if the goal is not you succeeding in life, but the goal is that he might have the supremacy of everything, the supremacy of Jesus is portrayed and experienced in the person, in the marriages, in the churches who walk like zombies, dead people. Dead people that literally recognizes that this is the generation that we must proclaim. We must understand that our deadness is the perfect scenario for us to experience Jesus coming into our rescue. This morning, I'm just going to ask you, if you're willing to recognize your condition and my condition, and you hunger the supremacy of Jesus, here is the catch. Here's what you will get if you this morning proclaim his supremacy. This is what you will get if you are willing to embrace the fullness of Jesus, is that God will be, look at me for a second. The tragedy for most of us is that we have tried to please ourselves. The tragedy of us is that we have tried to please people. And when we get rejected, our world collapses. We have tried to please our finances, please our security. When you embrace the supremacy of Jesus, there is one audience, one individual that will be pleased, and that's, so here's my question to you. As you make decisions through 2019, is God pleased? And the pleasure of God, look at this, the pleasure of God in your life is going to bring the, what's the win? It's the fullness of God. So think for a second. Jesus, obedience, cross, dead, graveside. It isn't the graveside. It is 3 days of deadness that allows God to be pleased. And when Jesus was at the deepest of suffering and sorrow, which is death, is when he experienced, because on the third day, what happened on the third day? The pleasure of God brings the Spirit of God into the lifeless, the corpse of Jesus. There is a Jewish body decomposing on that graveside 2,000 years ago, and literally the Spirit of God, because God is pleased, the fullness of God takes on that body, and the stone is removed, and that body comes into the fullness of God. So what comes out of the grave is not a better version of the Jewish carpenter. It's not a better version of what Mary and Joseph did raising that child. What is it that comes out of that graveside? It literally comes a resurrected body that describes the pleasure of God and the fullness of God. The beauty of this gospel for you is that you don't have to wait to die to experience this. Right now, as I speak to you, as a single man, married man, whatever you are in this case, as a young lady, you can live a life of pleasure, not yourself, not others, but the pleasure of God. And you can experience, in spite of the conditions, in spite of the brokenness, in spite of the difficulties and the misery and the confusion and the desolation, you can experience the fullness of God. If you are in this place and you are not yet at the place where your driving force is the pleasure of God and the fullness of God, I'm going to break it down very simple for you. You're not a Christian. You're not a follower of Jesus. If Jesus is only your cosmic butler that exists to pleasure you and to fulfill you, you're not saved. You haven't heard the gospel yet. The gospel is simply the message that he says, through Jesus, through the pleasure of God in Jesus, through the fullness of God in Jesus, the world is reconciled to him. The world will be reconciled to him, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making, what did he do? Jesus didn't stop world hunger. Jesus didn't run away the Romans. Jesus didn't finish, you know, cancer and brokenness and divorce. Jesus simply promised that in the middle of all this craziness, you will experience what? Have you met the peace of God? Are you at the place that you are willing to recognize that the price of your peace in your heart, in your mind, is the byproduct of the blood that was shed on a Roman cross? Your peace has a high price, and that price has been paid by Jesus Christ. This morning, my invitation is that you will open your heart, not to a better version, not to a better year, but to the peace of God that comes through the pleasure of God and through the fullness of the God of the Bible.